Hey, it's the Stick and Axe Show. This week, we have a conversation about the World Handicap System and what it means to you. We also tell you an amazing story of Francis Ouimet for the 1913 U.S. Open and what he did for golf. And Mike and I play Stick or Hack with 90s rock alternative bands, A through C. And Mike doesn't know what he's talking about.
Better Than Ezra sucks.
This is the Stick and Hack Show. Conversation, discussion, debate, and golf talk from a stick, Mike Ryan, and the hack, Adam Grubb. Boys, you are up.
Hey, everybody, welcome in to the Stick and Hack Show. I'm your host, Adam Grubb, the hack. That's Mike Ryan, the stick. Mike, how are you?
Super.
How dramatic was that?
It was.
That was timed out perfectly.
There's a little delay there.
I'm a professional.
Good.
There was no delay.
What do they call it? Hitting
awesome. Hitting the post.
Hitting the post.
Hitting that's the post in radio. Well, welcome into to the program here, the Stick and Axe Show, episode 27 of the most sophisticated golf show in the free world from the greatest golf club in the world without the course, presented by Manscaped. Go to manscaped.com and use the code STICKANDHACK for 20% off and free shipping of their products. And I have a Manscaped story for you here in just a second, Mike.
Oh God!
Yeah, exactly. We have a good show today. We've got a incredible golf story of the literal rags to riches, and the person that in most cases most people believe really started the United States golf revolution back in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
And that's something that you obviously want to listen to, but more importantly, the people don't remember. That golf wasn't popular here. It was popular overseas. It was popular in Scotland. It was popular in the Netherlands and in that area where land is all over the place. But bringing it over to the United States was basically one guy, one kid, and we'll tell the story here in just a little bit.
Yep.
Plus, we're going to talk about something that I probably the 6 months in here, 7 months into the year. Is still a topic of conversation at your course, whether it's municipal, whether it's your club, whether it's around the bar with your buddies, is the 2020 new handicap rules and the new system.
Mm-hmm.
The handicap conversation has been one over the last, I don't know, 1,000 years, whatever that might be, where nobody thinks it's fair. Nobody understands it. It is a necessary evil in golf. There are people that hate having to give strokes. There are people that think they should get more strokes. There are people that get upset when they have a good round because it's going to hurt their handicap.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And we're also going to tell a story about you and your incredible loss earlier this week.
Oh, God.
And how handicaps at that point hurt you, in essence.
Yep.
Now, we'll do the other side of the coin, how they played great and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. We'll make sure that we don't offend anybody, make anybody mad.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the conversation, the handicap system is in place to make golf fair for everybody. So that any given day, I could beat you, even though I'm a worse golfer than you. Golf has said, hey, let's make this more fair and let everybody play together, which on the surface makes sense and means the most.
Yep.
Also, we're going to play a game called Stick or Hack, which obviously comes from the title of our show and our brand, Stick and Hack. All right, so it's
really creative.
Thank you. I went to the beach over vacation, and you judge me if you will. Judge me if you want from afar, but you don't know my life. We had to get to the beach, or something drastic was going to happen inside my house, right?
You do you, man.
So we went to the beach, and luckily, I was, I don't know if you probably can't tell. You can't tell if you're listening to this. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can't tell. But this is pretty well sculpted underneath this long sleeve tee. Okay? It's a pretty well sculpted 41-year-old body.
That is lies.
All right? And people who say dad bod, they don't, that's no thank you. You want something like this, a hack bod. Okay? But I realized quickly as I was heading to the beach that, oh my God, I've got some 41-year-old hack bod hair issues, maybe on the little bit part of my middle of my back, maybe on the shoulder blade. You know, the chest area is pretty much like a baby seal up here. But for the most part, I was trying to get into beach shape.
Yep.
Thank God.
Yep.
You know where this is leading?
I think I do.
Thank God I had Manscaped and Manscaped.com. Go there for their incredible trimming and personal male grooming products. 20% off, free shipping. Use the code STICKANDHACK. But I was getting a lot of
compliments. Everyone you were with appreciated it.
Everybody appreciated it, Mike. They were coming up to me like, hey, you look phenomenal. And I said, well, thank you. And you can thank Manscaped for that. Manscaped.com, go check them out, and the proud sponsor of the Stick and Hack Show. The really was just a long read for me to tell you how great I look. Shocking?
Good job.
Thank you very much.
Not shocked.
All right, so, Mike, the first up here is really an incredible golf story that started over 100 years ago. At the country club in Brookline, Massachusetts, a 20-year-old former caddy walked across the street. He lived right across in this little modest home, very blue-collar upbringing, onto the grounds of one of the nation's most exclusive playgrounds for, at that time, the rich.
Yep.
And the golf course of Brookline, the country club in Brookline. Over the span of the week, he created the most astounding story in golf history. For the better part of four rounds, Francis Wiemett matched Vardon, one of the immortals of the game, Ray, another top British player, and until finally it seemed that Wiemett had run out of magic, he rallied two birdies, final six holes of regulation, decisively beat two veterans the next day, an 18-hole playoff in the U.S. Open to win as an amateur, as a 20-year-old, as a former caddy, as someone who didn't really even play golf, who didn't sit with the rich, who didn't do anything other than carry someone else's bag and practice hours and hours and hours. Francis Wiemett is one of the most prolific amateur players of all time.
Yep.
And in most cases is seen to be the one that started the golf revolution in the United States. Do you know his story? And do you know what he truly did for the game of golf, Mike?
I do know his story. I don't think it's ever really, and until I kind of read this story, really understood the impact it had on golf. I know it was I always knew it was a big story, but I didn't realize, I think, at the time how big it was, just because of it's a little harder to understand now because, you know, I would say golf is more of a welcoming game, especially compared to then.
Right.
So it's a little harder to understand the impact it had to us now, but it was huge. I mean, you had to be extremely, extremely wealthy to play golf, period.
It was like equestrian polo.
Just to get on the course.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
It was like you could practice, but
you could sneak on.
You could practice, but if you were probably practicing in a field somewhere.
Right. Yeah, you couldn't play.
You couldn't, like, get onto a course and play it without it costing you an immense amount of money.
And just so you know how important this was, Francis Wiemett winning the U.S. Open as an amateur made page one of the New York Times, which didn't happen back then. Sports events weren't like they are today, but making the front page of the New York Times for any sport event, let alone golf. And golf quickly went from a game from the very elite and the very rich to a game that was more accessible, not totally accessible, but more accessible than it had been before.
Yeah.
And that's according to a golf historian and author, Martin Davis, who has written multiple books about Francis and multiple books about the early days of golf here in the United States.
Yeah.
It was a foreign game at the turn of the century. It was not here.
Yeah.
And this just 100 years ago, golf was not really here. But thanks to what he did in 1913, the seed of American golf was planted. Jack Nicklaus said in a video that he made for Wiemett's Fund, which we'll talk about here in a second, Francis set the stage for the likes of Jones, Hagen, Hogan, Nelson, Snead, and Palmer.
Yep.
Listen to those names.
I know.
Without Francis Wiemett, Jones, Hagen, Hogan, Nelson, Snead, and Palmer are owning auto body shop in Sacramento.
Insurance salesman.
Right, insurance salesman. hosting their own podcast.
Yeah.
Golf World Magazine ranked Wiemett's open win as the most important moment in golf.
Yeah.
And it's that story that is not told. Tiger Woods, you see it, Tiger Woods is in some cases our Francis Wiemett because of what he did for the game, how he transcended the game, right?
Yeah.
What he did for kids and youth and bringing more people into the game.
Yeah.
But take yourself back to 1913 and how important as a young kid it would be to see another 20-year-old win the United States Open, which at that time was just as important as it is today.
Yeah. No, I agree. Absolutely. I mean, and when you think about you think about Tiger, he kind of took it to the next level as far as making it more accessible and bringing the amount of exposure to the game, because he was just so, I mean, Tiger's just, he's a whole other level of just the amount of attention that he has brought to golf.
Right.
Right. I think we met open the door from a, you know, just making it people actually thinking they could have access to the game. And then I think Tiger, once he, obviously there was a large gap there in time between Tiger and we met, but along the way there, you've got guys like Arnold Palmer, especially Arnold. He really was kind of like that next cog of kind of the everyman and blue collar guys thinking that they could have access to the game and actually play the game.
It's funny because you think about golf, and at the turn of the century or at the beginning of it, it was a rich man's game. And then all of these blue collar style guys, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, the middle America, the iron workers, they started coming in. They made golf more accessible. They made it more believable. They made it feel as if it was an everyman's game. But then at some point that shifted again.
Yeah.
And now it is still looked at as a preppy, rich environment, and the shape of players today, and I mean the physical shape, kind of like the hack bod, the physical shape of Dustin Johnson and Rory and Tiger and the fitness regime, Bryson DeChambeau, who is basically the Incredible Hulk. DeChambeau flex. They have changed again to make it look as if you have to be fit, you have to be well put together, and I think it's actually having the reverse effect. But I want to point this out, that I think the coolest part of this story is not what he did for golf and not how he transcended the game and moved the game. Francis Ouimet, who we're talking about, from the 1913 U.S. Open champion as an amateur at the age of 20, and he was a caddy. There was another ex-caddy that won the U.S. Open just 2 years before that, 1911.
Yep. And we talked about him.
Yeah, John McDermott.
Yes.
Now, he is not a household name. Francis Ouimet is. Why isn't John McDermott a household name? He was the first American-born player to win the U.S. Open. He was 19 years old, and he was an ex-caddy.
Yeah.
Why don't we say John McDermott changed the game?
Well, I think when he won, you know, he didn't beat really anybody that was of note at the time.
George Simpson and Mike Brady.
Exactly.
Mike Brady, by the way,
who
would go on to have a divorce and get remarried to Carol.
Yes.
And have six kids, three of his own and three from her. And they lived in California.
Yeah, and they had a housekeeper named Alice.
They did. Yeah, so that was the same Mike Brady from the 1911 U.S. Open.
I just think it wasn't, and that was the weird thing about professional golf back then, is the top players didn't play every year in every event.
Right.
Right. It was like this very, because there was no real concerted effort. There wasn't a PGA Tour that could kind of bring all these players together. So like, you know, you'd have guys from overseas that they wouldn't necessarily come and play over here.
Yeah.
Very often at all. Like, if they came, it was an event.
It took them 3 weeks to get here, first of all.
Exactly.
So the other reason is McDermott was a professional.
He
had gone, correct. And Ouimet was an amateur.
Yes,
and, absolutely. And so there was that. And then Ouimet was also, had come from kind of a very poor background and a very middle-class, working-class family.
Yeah.
Where McDermott, I believe, had some... Had connections and was well known in the golf space and kind of grown up in that.
And then he lost his mind.
And then he lost his mind. Correct. And never played again. You do listen to this show.
I do.
Oh, that's incredible. That makes me so proud.
Thank you.
More than producer Shane, who hasn't been off his phone since the show began.
and he's just a cog.
No, he's looking up Mike Brady.
Of course.
He's looking at Mike Brady right now.
What's Brady Bunch? What is that?
All right. So, The other thing is that they, or Ouimet specifically, and then McDermott, both within 2 years as ex-caddies, started this new feeling of in the caddy world, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
If they can win this tournament,
absolutely.
I could win the tournament.
Yeah.
So in New York, there was a young caddy named Eugenio Saracini.
Sure.
Eugenio. Saraceni is how I believe it's pronounced. And he heard and felt the ripples of Ouimet's earth-shattering U.S. Open win. And he wrote in his 1950 memoir, yep, Saraceni, 30 Years of Championship Golf, under his Americanized name, Gene Sarazen. Huh?
Yeah.
I just blew everyone's mind.
There it is.
Look at that. You guys, pull the car over, people, if you need a couple minutes to breathe. So Gene Sarazen, whose name was actually Eugenio Saraceni, Gene Sarazen was a caddy himself, and he received this new lease on his game and on life and on his what he wanted to accomplish, yeah, based upon Francis Ouimet, yeah, winning the 1913 U.S. Open.
Yep.
So instead of regarding caddies as cheap labor, golf clubs began to think of them as human beings whose ranks there might be another Ouimet who in future years could make the world of golf better. Sarazen would later become famous for his shot heard around the world, which was an albatross that helped him win the second Masters tournament, which the shot heard around the world is a story in and of itself and an entire, right, other episode.
Right.
But so Sarazen, who was a caddy, saw Francis Ouimet win and said, oh, my God, I can do this.
Yeah.
And he did. He won the, yeah, Masters. He was one of, yeah, the most prolific winners of the PGA and a name that still resonates today,
yeah,
in the Masters.
You know, there's another famous caddy that I'm surprised didn't come up in your research.
I apologize.
His name's Danny Noonan.
Oh, yeah.
Surprised he didn't come up with there.
Yeah, he should have. Danny Noonan. He's a very famous caddy.
Very famous caddy.
Who was able to do very well,
yes,
In
one particular match tournament. Against Judge
Smells. I can't remember. That's who it was.
Judge Smells.
Yeah, Judge Smells. I couldn't remember. Yeah. I couldn't put my finger on it. Yeah. Back in the 80s, I believe.
Yes.
Yes.
I believe you're correct.
Great. All right, so moving on. In 1927, 14 years after Ouimet's historic victory, the most famous caddy tournament ever played took place at Glen Garden Golf and Country Club in Fort Worth, Texas. That's right. They said, hey, caddies, let's have a tournament because all of a sudden these guys are saying, hey, let's do this.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, the two teenagers, this is going to blow your mind, Mike.
Okay.
Turn up your headphones. Shane, wake up. Here we go. Two teenagers that battled over 18 holes in the first ever caddy tournament at, yep, Glen Garden Golf and Country Club in Fort Worth, Texas. Byron Nelson beat Ben Hogan, ooh, by a single stroke, but both setting off on a path that would lead them to, of course,
yeah,
golf immortality. Byron Nelson, yeah, and Ben Hogan were in a caddy tournament in Texas and were placed first and second. Why? Francis Ouimet.
Yep.
See how that all comes back?
It's great.
How's that for
You're
research?
You're so good at research and like connecting all the dots.
I couldn't agree more. According to the 1916 American Annual Golf Guide, there were 742 courses in the U.S., and by 1920, that number had risen to 1,089,
okay,
including many muni courses and public courses.
Yep.
According to the Ouimet Fund, there were approximately 350,000 golfers in the U.S. around 1913, and within 10 years, that figure had skyrocketed to 2.1 million.
Wow.
So by 1923, there were 2.1 million golfers in the United States because,
yeah,
of the growth,
yeah,
of Francis Ouimet.
That's awesome.
Ouimet also, he provides college, he's obviously passed away now, he'd be 285 years old, but Ouimet continued to provide college scholarship money through the Francis Ouimet Scholarship Fund, which in 2013 surpassed $26.5 million in scholarships. So even in death. And I think there's a family connection locally here in in the Indianapolis area where,
really?
Stick and Hack is headquartered, the worldwide global headquarters of Stick and Hack. There's a relative, some sort of a bloodline relative to Francis Ouimet, who Snapchats my daughter. That's the end of that story. I'm not going to talk about it anymore.
I'm sure that makes you very...
Doesn't make me happy.
Oh, okay.
Doesn't make me happy. All right, so now let's talk about the conversation, Mike.
Okay.
And that's the World Handicap System. So in 2020, at the start of this year, they changed the rules for the handicap system, which they could change them every year and nobody would know them. Nobody would understand them.
Yep.
It is as confusing as ever before, but yet still, in some circles, people think it's fairer. So if you could, as plainly as possible, to the hacks out there, and even to the sticks that still don't fully understand it,
Yep.
Tell me about the new regulations. We're 7 months into the year here and the 2020 handicap system. What does it mean and what do people need to know? What are the facts?
So to me, the biggest, well, there's a couple pretty big changes, but to me, the biggest one is that they now revise your handicap daily or based on how often you post. So right. If you post a score today, that hits your handicap tomorrow. Prior, it was twice a month, so you would have this lull where you could be playing really well and still be getting probably additional strokes you shouldn't be getting.
Right. So that part makes it more fair.
Because if I'm playing
well in a week span and I've got that energy and that passion and that drive and everything's working.
Yes.
I'm not getting extra strokes
yes.
against a competitor
correct.
Anymore.
Another big change is prior it was 10 scores that they would count of your last 20. Now they only count 8 of your last 20. So they're shortening. It's basically your best 8 scores.
Best 8
out of
scores.
Your last 20. And that's basically shrinking that sample size so that in theory the number that you are at is closer to how you're actually playing currently.
Right then,
at that moment.
And that part I agree with 100%.
Yes.
But it sucks. Because if you're coming into a tournament, if you're coming into something where you know, a money game or there's something where, and you are playing well, historically you have...
Now, what I will say, what I think is probably the most difficult part of it is if you are playing poorly and you are a higher handicapper, it takes longer for your handicap to actually go up.
Okay.
Right?
So
it's a longer curve because you have to have those worse before those bad scores are going to really like leak into your best eight. It's going to take a little longer.
Yet if you play well 3 days, three rounds in a row,
It will drop you faster. Yes.
So,
because that's really looking at what is your potential to be able to shoot a score around, and it's trying to take that into account.
So what a handicap is not saying is just an average of your scores recently and averaging those up and saying here's your handicap.
Yeah.
What the handicap is saying is that if you're playing well, you could, and based upon your scores and the trends, you could shoot this, right?
Yep.
And therefore, that's the amount of strokes you would get against a scratch player like yourself.
Yep.
Where the problem comes in are the misconceptions of the handicap system, which one is that it's an average of, when really it is a potential to shoot a score of X.
And they actually have there's actually also a new piece to this as well that's around looking at if you shoot an abnormally low score. So say your score is 7 strokes lower than what your index indicates you're at.
What's the difference between an index and a handicap?
Index is... Okay, so index is the number that is basically your universal handicap number. So like my index is a 0.8.
Okay,
but then
very impressive.
Thank you.
Okay, 0.8
is like a 0.8.
Okay,
but if you look at my course handicap at a given course, that number can go up or down.
Based upon how difficult the course is?
The slope and the rating, and then basically the slope and rating of the tees that you're playing. So depending on which tees you're playing, there's a different slope and rating for every course, right? So it gets harder or easier. So based on that actual handicap number goes up or down. So like at the course I play at, if I play our back tees, I'm actually a 2 handicap. If I play one up from that, I'm a 0.
Okay. So... A 2 handicap means that against a 0 handicap on that same course, you would get 2 strokes.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Okay. And the slope and rating are one number, two numbers? Are they?
Two numbers.
Two numbers. So slope is one number.
Slope is like a 3-digit number.
And that's the...
Like one, like 123 or something like that.
And you want that...
The higher that number is, the harder the course is.
Okay. So Oakmont would be 147.
I don't know.
Right.
Maybe.
Well, that wasn't a quiz.
But like 130, like 130 is like really hard.
Okay. So 130 is that starts to creep into difficult, which then would put your handicap up higher because they know, they're saying, hey, this course is tougher,
more difficult. Yeah.
Therefore, you're going to get some extra shots because we know you're probably going to hit a lot of terrible shots into the rough.
Yes.
Okay. And a par 70 Muni course that's 5,000 yards, you're going to have that at a much lower slope.
Correct.
Okay. And then the rating is what?
The rating is the...
that's usually a 70, 72, 72.5.
Yeah, it's basically like what the real, I guess, par is, what you would consider par based on the difficulty of the course. So the par of the course might be 71, but the rating might be 73.6. So in their eyes, if you shoot par, you actually shot two under.
Oh, that's good.
In theory.
Okay, in theory.
That based on how the rating would work. So, right, so, like, if you're looking at, so, like, in my case, with our course, if I'm playing our back tees, I'm almost, I'm my index is basically a zero, but my handicap is a two.
Right.
So, basically, if I shoot two over par, that's basically a zero.
Yeah, and that's where my head starts to spin, and I get frustrated.
You
know what I mean?
Yeah, it can get confusing for sure.
And then, and so, why do people get mad when you're better than your handicap? So we hear this all the time.
Yeah.
And it's a funny, it's a funny saying. That's some 12, that's some 15 when they hit a good shot. Being a 15 handicap doesn't mean that you can't play golf. Being a 20 handicap doesn't mean you still can't every now and then hit the face of the club and put it onto the green and then two putt. You can do that. That's possible.
Yes.
People get upset when you don't play to your handicap. If you play well, it's the only sport that I know that if you are playing your best, and we've talked about this countless times, and we talked about it last episode of Golf Guilt, you're playing your best round, and you feel guilty or bad because you're beating somebody, because you're getting strokes, and you're playing well, it's a very difficult and annoying position to be in.
Sure.
So why do people get mad when you're playing above your handicap? It doesn't mean the handicap isn't what you have to hit. It's just what you should.
Right. It's well, so it's a number for that helps you judge, well, how well did you actually play versus your actual ability, right?
My ability is what I played, which is great.
Well,
right.
I don't understand that.
So if someone is mad at you for besting your own ability and playing great, now that's my new ability.
They shouldn't be mad. It happens. It happens all the time. Somebody plays well on a given day, and if they're playing better than what they normally would, it happens. Now,
do you remember Bartolo
Colon? Where people, I think,
hold on a second. I just want. I'm sorry, but this is a sidebar that
Bartolo Colon.
Do you remember Bartolo Colon?
Yes,
the pitcher, the fat pitcher.
Yes,
he hit a home run.
Yep,
he's not supposed to do that.
No, but he did.
But when he hit his home run and he came around, everyone congratulated him and everybody was cheering because he did something he wasn't supposed to do. If I did that in golf and I shot a 75, which I shouldn't do because I've never done it before, I would be chastised out of and pushed out of the club because I just took $1,000 off somebody that has a gambling problem.
I don't think it's I don't think it's for one score. I think it's if it's a consistent pattern.
Okay.
That's where people get upset.
Okay.
In my experience.
Right.
Like if I go out and I play a guy and he just plays better than he normally does and shoots, you know, a number that's under his handicap, that's fine. I can handle that.
All right.
But if it's a consistent, like, every time you go out, somebody's, and you see people winning tournaments consistently that statistically they shouldn't be able to win, that's when people get upset.
I can, Mike is, for those of you at home, Mike is ramping up to a story. You shot 66 the other day. Your partner shot well below his number. You shot a 66.
I did.
You were 5 under.
Yes.
Because our course is 71. You played lights out, unbelievable, and you guys got killed.
We didn't get killed.
Yeah, you did. You got beat. We got killed.
We got beat.
Absolutely murdered.
We didn't get killed.
Did you win?
Got beat. No, we lost.
Yeah, you got killed.
We lost on 18. But it took, it took a lot to get to 18.
Right, right. You guys were down 2-3 at the turn. I mean, things were bad.
Yes.
And you got beat by a tandem.
It was a one man best ball. It was just they for lack of a better term, and
they are listening.
Most golf,
we know that. They're
100%. They're both Stick and Hack. They're both Stick and Hack members.
Fanboys,
friends of mine.
Fanboys.
They ham and egged it, if you will. It's the old ham and egg.
That's
eggs
one of the
scenario.
Worst sayings in golf.
One of them would play a bad hole. The other one would play saying. Good. It was so literally stupid. Like the entire. It was like the entire right. round.
So, but their handicaps helped them because it gave them an advantage on holes. But some would look at that as not an advantage. It's right. just. Shoring up
the, it was just the way the it landed. It was like it was literally it was one of the strangest rounds I've ever been a part of in that if you just looked at the scores, you would have said we won by a lot.
5-4.
And
you got murdered.
We lost.
Yeah, you got killed.
We lost. You're not helping out.
That wasn't much.
You're not helping me get over this loss.
I wasn't trying. I'm not trying to.
I know you're not.
I'm bringing it back up.
You're not helping me.
No, we'll talk about this every episode till the end of time.
I know. It was, it was a great match. It was right. a fantastic match. Yeah. It was one of the best, most competitive matches I've probably ever been a part of. It was really good.
Yeah.
It was fun. It sucks to lose, but
and it's because of the handicap system.
But the handicap system made it fun. That's right. I agree. I absolutely agree with that. And, but it's one of those things that. It's just sometimes it's hard to swallow.
Yeah.
But it is what it is, and you have to deal with that.
Right.
But it's what makes golf great.
Yeah, it is.
And allows people of not as high of a skill level be able to compete with people of a higher skill level. So
are you talking about those guys specifically?
Well, they would admit that. They would say that.
I don't know. Well, they beat you handily.
They did.
They beat you handily. 66, though, dude. That's impressive.
I missed two putts. If I would have made them, I would have shot my all-time low round, and we would have won by one.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
But it is what it is.
All right. Speaking of not making any sense, three doors down. The game is called Sticker Hack. All right. And we're gonna talk about bands from the 90s. These are alternative bands from the 90s, and the game is Stick or Hack. So we're going to have a conversation if these bands are sticks or hacks, all right?
Okay.
And I put this list together, and then I quickly realized that I copied and pasted the list, and I only got it's in alphabetical order. So I only got to C here. So this isn't a complete list of A to Z. It's literally the alternative bands from the 90s that start either with a numeral or A, B, or C. Oh, what an idiot.
That's fine.
All right, so...
it's a list.
Yeah, it's a list.
It's something to go
and
with.
And it's written down, so that's we're already in a good spot.
Yeah.
All right, three doors down. Stick or Hack? I have a buddy, this is his favorite band, and I can't for the life of me understand
hack.
Why. Hack, 100% Hack.
Yeah.
They have one song that catches my attention.
Yeah.
But then I realize, oh, man, I'm listening to Three Doors Down. I should probably not do that.
No.
Second, 311.
Stick.
Oh, right out of the gate. Yeah. I never really got into them.
They're fantastic.
If
you've never been to a show of their live shows are amazing.
I think they reunited for a little bit, didn't they? Are they still out
touring.
There? They still
touring.
Yeah, I think they still do tour.
They still tour.
Look who woke up.
A lot.
Shane's back.
Yeah, Shane.
Producer Shane finally said, oh, wait, are we doing a show?
What?
Let me look at the monitor.
Yeah.
Let me turn up my headphones and listen.
Yeah, no, 311's fantastic.
Allison. Oh, wow.
Excuse me. For a second.
Okay,
let's discuss it.
Let's discuss
311. 311 is one of those bands that I think there are probably a lot of people that they only remember them for like one song, but as a band, they were really good.
What was the name of their one hit?
Down.
Yeah, that song.
That was their big, like,
that song.
Really big hit, but they've got other ones that they've had since that have had pretty good success, but as a band, they're really good, and they're fun to watch in live.
Alice in Chains.
Stick.
I don't know. Yes. They, Alice in Chains didn't do much for me.
Alice in Chains is amazing.
Really?
Yes.
No, nothing.
Lane Staley?
I don't know. Who? Lane Staley?
Yeah.
Yeah, lead singer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did he kill himself? Is he dead?
He's dead.
Drugs.
I think he overdosed.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Shocking. Sure. Shock of the year. You could probably go down this list and most of that would be same answer.
I'm sure.
Better Than Ezra.
Hack.
You're out of your mind. You're out of your mind. That's a stick band if I've ever heard. Better Than Ezra? Good? Come on, man.
No.
Better Than Ezra in 1996, 97.
No.
That was feel good music. That got me excited for the day.
They had like one song.
No, they did not. They had
maybe two.
They had some good albums.
I disagree.
No. You're wrong. You're a hack. Blind Melon.
Stick.
Stick, but they are looked at as hacks because of No Rain. Yeah. Only because of the Bumblebee, because of one song.
Well, that and their lead singer also.
Oh, what did he do? What happened?
He died.
Oh, really? Drug overdose.
I'm just saying.
Maybe did he kill him? He might have killed himself. That's the game we should have.
No, which, I'm pretty sure he. I'm 90s, pretty sure. He, yeah,
90s rock alternative lead singer killed himself.
Suicide or OD.
Sorry, we don't want to make fun of that.
No, we're not. I do apologize. Not at all. Not at all.
So Blind Melon, we're calling Stick, but most people look at them as hack, right? Because they have great songs, but because of No Rain, they're looked at as
I thought they were great. Yeah, they were great. I think the problem with them is because he died, it was very early on in their success.
Right.
They didn't really get a chance to like add to the stable.
Correct.
So
Bloodhound Gang. Remember those guys?
Yeah, they are...
Hack.
I feel like they're a guilty pleasure.
Yeah, which makes them a hack.
Yeah.
Blur. Stick, 100%. Blur.
Maybe.
No, Blur was that band that...
They're kind of... I don't know.
Here's why I think Blur was Stick, because most kids then didn't listen to Blur. That wasn't what they listened to. They listened to Better Than Ezra because they were on the radio. Blur wasn't really on the radio. But if you knew Blur songs and you listened to them, that made you cool, made you on the outside of that alternative.
I hate that.
Well, I'm just telling you why
there's so many people that are like music, I call them music snobs, that are just like, yeah, but you got to be on the outside of it. They can't be mainstream or whatever. Who cares? If they're good, they're good.
All right. Bush.
Stick.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, Stick.
Yeah. Bush in the day, even today, I could listen to Glycerine, and I could listen to Come Down, I could listen to all of those songs, and it just takes me back to that moment in my life that I'm like, oh, in two notes of Glycerine. Now, Glycerine, for Bush fans, is probably like Crash Into Me for Dave Matthews fans, where you're like, oh, my God, Crash Into Me again.
I agree.
But... that Bush was the best.
Yeah, Gavin Rossdale is really good.
And he was just a charismatic, cool lead singer.
He's been doing
and
some...
And he's alive.
During COVID.
So that's good.
Yeah. During COVID, he's done some like live stuff, like live streaming stuff that's been really good.
I saw we're not going to get to G's here, but Goo Goo Dolls is another sticker hack that I'm going to put in there and ask you. You say hack?
Yeah.
Crazy. Stick. 100%.
I'm not a Goo Goo Dolls person, sorry.
Stick. 100%. And not only that, but they're
not a fan.
He's had a lot of work done, and I don't know if you've noticed his face, but it hasn't changed in 25 years.
I haven't seen him lately.
He's the male version of Tori Spelling.
Because I don't listen to them.
By the way, if that joke didn't make you laugh, I don't know what will, people. He's the lead singer of Goo Goo Dolls. Butthole Surfers.
I feel like I know what you're gonna say, but I'm saying hack.
I'm saying hack.
Okay, cool.
100%.
Good, thank God.
Hack.
Not a Butthole Surfers.
No. Fan. I'm glad you said fan at the end.
Thanks.
That's a weird sentence to say. Cake?
Cake. Stick. Oh,
no.
What?
No.
Are you kidding me?
What was the name of the song? No Distance?
They have many songs.
I never got into them.
They are musically extremely talented.
Really? I never got into them. Maybe I'll put that in my 54.
They have they have a horn section. They're incredible.
Candlebox.
Why
are you waiting? That is Stick 100% right out of the gate.
I don't think so.
You're at Stick, boys.
Sure.
No, I don't. You're not coming into the show. Just give me a thumbs up.
Fine.
Producer Shane wants to get a mic on.
Fine.
Is that guy for real?
Well, this is up his. This is his.
Yeah, it is.
This is his bag.
Candlebox. Collective.
This is his bag.
Collective Soul.
Stick.
Yep. Stick and Counting Crows.
I can't do it.
Stick. No. Counting Crows in the 90s were the band that I couldn't get enough of. There's a live album called...
I had a roommate in college that was obsessed with Counting Crows, and me and my other roommate consistently berated him for it.
I interviewed Adam Duritz, lead singer of Counting Crows.
It was
the strangest interview I've ever had. It was Sugar Ray, Counting Crows in live concert, Levi's Fuse 99, and it was unbelievable. But he's very strange, and he's too theatrical now. But back then, Counting Crows, they were the thing. There's a live album called Live Across the Wire, and you should check it out because it's whatever. Very, very good.
Whatever.
I'm just telling you. Well, we won't do the show anymore then, Mike. We'll just stop this whole thing if this is how it's going to be. Sorry, I disagree with you.
Fine.
And I'm going to go listen to, you're going to listen to Blind Melon, and I'm going to listen to, who, Blur?
Cake.
Cake. That's right.
Cake.
All right, so we'll listen to those. Stick and Hack Show brought to you by Manscaped. Manscaped.com, 20% off. Use the code Stick and Hack, plus free shipping. And there's really nothing that you need to do more than take care of yourself by Manscaped, right?
Always.
All right. Coming up next.
I don't know why people, like, if you haven't gone to Manscaped.com yet, what the hell are you waiting for?
That's a very, really good read.
Thank you.
Hell of an ad lib, Mike.
I don't get it.
Just go there. Just do it. What is the issue? Just handle it.
It's kind of like better than Ezra.
We've got
I
the
don't understand.
We've got the golfer MD on the show next time, and he's got an incredible story, and we're excited for him. Thanks for listening to the Stick and Hack Show, Mike. Proud of you. Congratulations
proud
on
you,
just all of your success, including getting beat in that tournament.
Thanks.
With your best score of the year.
Peace out, guys.
The Stick and Hack Show is now over. Subscribe, rate, comment, and tell your friends. You are now free to go about your day.